because that's who you're going to vote for doesn't mean you then have to agree with everything they say.
Will you be voting for Senator Sanders?
I will be voting for Senator Sanders. I have tried to avoid this question, but yes, I will be voting for Senator Sanders. I try to avoid that because I want to write as a journalist, you know what I mean, and separate that from my role as, I don't know, a private citizen. But I don't think much is accomplished by ducking the question. Yes, I will vote for Senator Sanders. My son influenced me.
And your son is right here, right outside of the studio. Well, I want to thank you, Ta-Nehisi Coates, for joining us. I have a few more questions for you. We'll do a post-show, and we'll post it at democracynow.org. Ta-Nehisi Coates, national correspondent at The Atlantic, writes about culture, politics and social issues. We'll link to his piece in The Atlantic about reparations and wrote the book Between the World and Me. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. Up next is the volunteer-produced evening news. First, a little info just for you.
Help us celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the Confessional Radio Show with Contessa de la Luna. We have performances by Contessa de la Luna herself, Remy Fasolatido, Mike Crenshaw, and many more. We have plenty of audience participation, including human shadow puppet theater, animal impersonation contests, and prizes, prizes, prizes. And don't miss our David Bowie Kazoo tribute. All that and more, Thursday, February 11th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Tickets are $10 for an entire night of music, mayhem, laughs, and surprises. All proceeds benefit KBOO Community Radio. Tickets available now in advance at brownpapertickets.com or at the door. Join us Thursday, February 11th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. See you there.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the screening of Fix It, Healthcare at the Tipping Point, Saturday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Fix It is a documentary that delves deeply into the faults of the current healthcare crisis and proposes a single-payer system as a solution. Again, the screening of Fix It will be Saturday, February 13th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a second glass factory suspends the use of cadmium and arsenic in its production process.
Free Hot Soup brings delicious homemade soup to the houseless people in Portland and Vancouver. We have their organizers live in studio to talk about the program.
And on News from the Boo, Mike Crenshaw interviews Pamela Santos about the station's plans for growing our member base.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 10th, 2016. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The sheriff of Grant County, Oregon, is under investigation by the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Grant County Sheriff Glenn Palmer has come under fire after citizens complained about remarks he made during the continuing occupation at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. Prior to the arrest of Ammon Bundy, Sheriff Palmer suggested that the federal government should consider meeting some of the militants' demands. Leaders of the armed occupation were headed to the town of John Day in Grant County in order to meet with Sheriff Palmer on the day that they were pulled over and arrested by federal authorities. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association, or OSSA, has launched an investigation into whether or not Sheriff Palmer has violated any of the association's bylaws. Even if the OSSA finds that Sheriff Palmer violated those bylaws, the association has no authority to impact Palmer's elected position as sheriff. However, the association can strip Palmer of his membership, which would make him the only sheriff in Oregon to not have OSSA membership. Sheriff Palmer is known as a member of the Organization of Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, a group that claims the county sheriffs have supreme law enforcement powers in their counties. The Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association named Palmer the group's Lawman of the Year in 2012. The Southern Poverty Law Center has identified that organization as being anti-government. Leaders in Grant County held a public meeting today where they proposed a resolution condemning the occupation at the refuge in neighboring Harney County. That resolution received largely positive support from the community. Commissioners are expected to vote on the resolution early next week.
Time is running out on an ultimatum given by Governor Kate Brown to the Oregon Health Authority and Department of Environmental Quality. Governor Brown is demanding an answer about toxic air pollution from a Portland glass company and when the company became aware of it. The glass company in question has until this Friday to provide those answers. Meanwhile, a standing room only crowd filled Cleveland High School last night as health authority and DEQ officials stood on stage to be grilled on the issue from the floor by adults and even one child. Little was disclosed at the event, except that officials had few answers to the question of why the Bullseye Glass Company was able to remain compliant to DEQ restrictions, but still emit arsenic and cadmium into the air. The two toxic chemicals are key in making red, orange, and yellow glass. Bullseye has voluntarily stopped using the toxic chemicals and is cooperating with the state's investigation. Today, a second glass factory voluntarily stopped using cadmium and arsenic. Ouroboros Glass is located in North Portland near a second recorded spike in air toxins near the former Harriet Tubman Middle School. National DEQ tests have for years shown the area near Tubman to be one of the most toxic in the country.
An industrial chemical is showing up in trout caught in the Great Lakes. The chemical is known as FBSA, and researchers have traced the chemical back to several products on the market. Those include detergents and surfactants first used in 2003. Surfactants are materials made to stain-proof and waterproof products. More on this story from the Environment Report.
Testing Flint water. This is the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams. The Environmental Protection Agency recently announced it's stepping in to test water in Flint. Mark Durno is the on-scene coordinator for the EPA. He says the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality is still in charge of testing for lead in water samples from people's homes. Durno says the EPA is then going into the small number of homes with very high lead levels to find out what's going on. The DEQ did not require Flint to treat its water to prevent lead from leaching from old pipes and faucets.
One of the things we believe is happening within the water system is when the pipes were corroding, the corrosion breaks off into flakes or scale. And that scale then floats through the system and comes out the tap. And even a small piece of that scale can create a high lead level.
He says they're testing water filters in those homes to see if they still work at those high lead levels. This week, state officials said the vast majority of the almost 5,000 water samples they've tested are below the federal limit for lead in water. So far, about 7% of samples have come in above that limit. This is the Environment Report. An industrial chemical is showing up in trout from the Great Lakes. It's called perfluoro-1-butane sulfonamide, or FBSA. Lindsay Scullin has more.
Researchers traced this chemical back to several products. Those include detergents and stain-proofing products first used in 2003. Robert Letcher is a senior research scientist for Environment and Climate Change Canada. That's a department in the Canadian government. Almost all of the fish his team tested had detectable levels of this FBSA chemical in their bodies. We're talking low levels here, parts per billion low. Letcher says it was a surprise to find the chemical in fish.
We were the first to ever find this compound in the environment, like to demonstrate its presence. It's never been reported before.
The researchers don't know if other chemicals are breaking down into FBSA in the environment or if the chemical is coming straight from industrial products. Letcher says companies started using FBSA to replace a different chemical. Studies showed that previous chemical was breaking down and part of it was building up in the food web. In 2006, the Environmental Protection Agency put together an industry-wide agreement to phase that chemical out. So industries replaced it with chemicals like FBSA. And that's the chemical Letcher and his team are now finding in fish. He says scientists often have to play catch-up to figure out if there are problems with new chemicals brought onto the market.
When a body of evidence, scientific evidence, builds up great enough to basically render a negative decision against a compound and it gets regulated or what have you, companies phase these compounds out and they look for alternatives in which to use that are safer, but also to serve their purpose.
He says research into FBSA is so new, they just don't know much about what this might mean for fish or people who eat the fish.
It's completely impossible to tell because nobody's done anything with regard to toxicology. That's usually the way things go. You know, somebody like us, we find a new chemical, and in this case in fish, and obviously a lot of aquatic fish toxicologists out there are going, well, you know, we should really try to understand what this chemical is doing to the fish, or not is doing, but could be doing to the fish.
Letcher says one of the next steps is to look at other species in the food web. That way, his team can figure out if the chemical is building up in other creatures. The study was published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology. For the Environment Report, I'm Lindsay Scullin.
That's the Environment Report for today. I'm Rebecca Williams.
Thousands of residents are still displaced from the community of Porter Ranch in LA's San Fernando Valley as methane continues to spew from a massive natural gas leak. This week, LA County filed criminal charges against the Southern California Gas Company. Attorney General Kamala Harris added yet another lawsuit alleging health and safety violations. She says the leak harms all of California by spiking greenhouse gas emissions. We talk with one of those displaced from Porter Ranch, California's Secretary of State Alex Padilla. Sasha Kokua has a story from the California Report.
Headlines periodically blare that this regulator or that has imposed another jaw-dropping assessment.
Oh. Sorry, that is not the audio we were looking for. We'll come back to that in just a minute.
Poverty, hunger, and houselessness have grown in Portland at the same time that the increasing number of luxury apartments and expensive restaurants have been added to the city. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales this week rolled out a new plan for dealing with the crisis, which the KBOO News detailed last night. Some Portlanders have already been running their own program to meet the city's needs. We're joined tonight by the organizers of Free Hot Soup. We've got with us Razdani Fallon, Benji Bao Vong, and Abby Schwalb. Thank you, all three of you, for joining us tonight. How are you all doing?
Pretty good.
Great. Thanks for having us.
All right, so let's get to the very basic most question here, which is, what is Free Hot Soup? What do you do and how do you do it?
We feed people. What I do is make a soup every Tuesday, and I've been doing it for 2 years, a little over 2 years now. There's hungry people out there. I make a soup. I have a lot of time on my hands. I make a soup. I share it with people.
And what made you decide to start this project? And feel free to jump in, guys.
Okay, well, I didn't start the project. A friend of mine, Lindsay, made a soup and made an announcement about it, about having it available for someone to pick up and deliver and serve to this specific spot. And then she posted the link to this Facebook page, which I had never seen before. Anyways, I got involved. I went down there, picked up the soup in Clackamas, drove it downtown, served it with another lady and a couple other people, and I was hooked. I had to keep it up.
How frequently are you doing it, and how much are you producing when you do it?
Well, I think that we serve downtown to anyone who needs. Right now, usually 5 days a week. Obviously, we have people who have lives, and everyone's volunteers, so sometimes people have to drop off, and that might get missed. But generally, five nights a week downtown. And I think that generally people are serving 5-plus gallons and usually gone in like 30 to 45 minutes pretty quickly.
Easily.
So sometimes if someone's able, has the capacity, then they'll do more than that. We also do mobile runs, which is what I'm involved in. So specifically in the winter, when the temps drop down low, we fill up our cars with hot soup, whatever other food we have, blankets, clothing, gloves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and drive around, particularly to the areas that are a little bit farther away from downtown, and make sure that people are fed and have the necessities they need for winter. So we kind of do both of those things.
Do you always go to the same spots, or do you try to find where mm-hmm. houseless folks are at any given time?
Yeah, for the mobile runs, we predominantly are starting in Southeast, simply because the majority of the services are not in that location. So we want to hit people who it's not easily accessible for them to get to those spots. So we do a lot in Southeast. We have a Gresham group, so the Gresham group is serving folks out there, and often in northwest, we'll go over there under the bridges into the industrial area. We pretty much do everything. It depends on how much food we have. We basically will go out until we run out of food.
There's also a need for just we try to reach people out to make sure that accessibility is not an issue. So there are a lot of resources out there. It's just bridging the gap for accessibility is an issue. So we do try to partner with community groups or local grassroots groups who are, activists or whatever, who is willing to do it. And then sometimes we'll have bicycle runs who run out and reach out to people that, either they're disabled or they have a tent set up where they can't leave their site, or, someone has to be down the hole, down the fort or whatever. So we try to make it accessible for people as much as we can. So.
And when you're out there on the street serving people, what are you seeing?
A lot of hungry people. We served over 60 people last night. We probably fed 100 people, because we went to the SOS
Women's Shelter
on 5th and Link. We spent some time there, fed a bunch of ladies and some other people there, and then we went up to 6th and Morrison, which is our base, kind of, although we're going to move to Director Park because of some issues with TriMet. But I'm seeing a lot of hungry people out there. That's what I'm seeing.
I mean, aside from hungry people, I think it's important to think about, we're seeing elderly people, we're seeing disabled people, we're seeing families, we're seeing vets, we're seeing people with awful addictions, or
people with jobs, even
mental health, people with jobs that don't make enough money to, have a place to live. So there's an amazing array of people on the streets, and I think that there's kind of a lot of times there's that stereotype of who that homeless person is, and there is no stereotype of who that person is. That person is any number of things, combinations of things that, are all very unique. So
I think it's important to hit the stigma of being houseless is the term that I prefer, because I've been corrected by people when I use homeless. They say, well, just because I don't have a house doesn't mean I don't have a home. And so I prefer to use the term houseless. And I think the majority of people tend to see panhandlers, for lack of better words, who stand on the highway. And, they're stuck in traffic, and often their image of what a houseless person is, that they're out there panhandling, they're being lazy, they're not actively looking for a job. I've worked in social services for almost a decade, and, for many years, and I actually work with drug addictions, and I see a plethora of all kinds of people, and it's really disheartening when I have, clients who come in who are indeed houseless, and they're a family unit, and they have to be separated because of domestic abuse or domestic violence, or they have an addiction that can't be treated because they're not eligible for benefits or so forth. And it's really hard to see that need that's there, but you can't tap into it and help them because of government bureaucracies or policies that are not, in effect to help them. And so the reason that we started this whole volunteer program that is completely 100% community run and organized is so that we don't have to deal with that, and that we're not an existing entity of any kind of bureaucracy source, and we just go out and volunteer our time and extra resource that we have. And I think it's important to hit that, we see all kinds of people, and I do see, equally as much as employed people who do not make enough to have their own housing, or people with mental health issues who are not able to afford that kind of amenities. So there's all kinds of people that we run into.
Since the issue of houselessness and poverty and hunger in Portland seems to be, it's not going away, what are your prospects for being able to expand your program, and have you had success working with partner programs to get food out there onto the streets?
Well, I think for me personally, it's not about expanding the program. If anything, I would like to see it reduced, because that means that we're succeeding in what we're trying to do, is reducing the number of time that we have to come out to help people and assist people. We do. I make an effort myself personally to try to partner with a community partners, you know, Street Roots, the shelters. I try to stay informed and aware, and then I relay these information back to people when I feel appropriate. If someone approached me, and if they're a juvenile, they're under certain age, and certain access or certain resources available to them, I would refer them to that. So I try to keep that up to date. I don't plan on expanding, and I acknowledge that this effort is no more than just a Band-Aid over a systemic issue. And until we have some kind of legislation laid down that would correct that, it's not going to resolve our housing crisis and all that. So,
well, let's switch gears for just a minute here and talk about the soup itself. What kind of recipes do you have, and how did you come up with them?
I do a vegetable soup every week. We don't believe in meat products.
Danny, we do serve meat on other nights.
Yeah,
Danny's
other nights night do it. Tuesday night is vegetarian night. I think it just feeding meat to people helps support the worst polluter in the world. But the soup I make is just vegetable. I work with whatever comes to me at different times. Sometimes I have a friend during the summer and the spring and the summer who has a garden going in his front yard that supplies me with a lot of kale and some other things. And I know some other people that have gleaned some stuff from their gardens that they've helped with. And that usually might be what I base my soup on, you know, or I'll build it around whatever kind of vegetable I happen to have, you know. I make about 12 or 13 gallons lately every week.
Wow. That's crazy.
That's a lot of soup. So why soup? Couldn't you just give people bagels or sandwiches?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot of love in soup. Soup's kind of it's kind of like it's kind of like the people that we're feeding. They come from all over the place, and soup's got all kinds of stuff in it. And everywhere you go, in every different culture you go, in every ethnicity, everybody's got a soup. You know, they got their soup, you know, and soup's just like, it's commonplace.
I think it feels to me when I go out and serve soup that I know that someone has spent hours and we're pretty crafty with getting, and when I say donations, I mean like, hey, I have a sack of potatoes if anybody wants it, or hey, I have some extra. What I mean,
Nextdoor app is fabulous
for that. I mean, literally taking whatever we have, driving, Benji and I do a lot of driving around. You know, I have a sack of beans in my car. I'm gonna go drop off to someone, and just literally someone taking whatever they've gotten on their hands, chopping it up, putting some amazing spices in it, and then it's nutritious. It's something that when someone eats it, they know that it's not just like whatever someone had. There was thought and love and nutrition being given to that.
So it sounds like you're able to source a lot of the vegetables going in locally.
That's true.
And just, I know we're running short on time, but I do want to emphasize on a note on soup. Originally, we started because I had a friend who was a chef and was able to offer a huge amount of soup to donate, and we started with that. Not only that, but it a lot of people that we deal with, the demographic that we deal with, they have a lot of dietary sensitivity. So soup is a nutritious way of providing that easily and to provide in mass. Whereas if you think about like bagels or, you know, breads and stuff like that, it's hard for some people to digest. And so we opted to go with soup because it's easy to, you know, to serve in mass.
So I just want to quickly mention, we're almost out of time, but we just received a phone call from someone who wanted to make a food donation to you guys. And I'd like you guys to let the listeners know, if they're interested in making donations to the program, how can they get a hold of you?
I think the best option is to just join our Facebook page. We coordinate on Facebook. And if you go to Facebook and you type in Free Hot Soup, there's a whole list of a bunch of places that we are. The main one is just plainly Free Hot Soup. So if you look up on Facebook Free Hot Soup and join that group, we can coordinate online on Facebook. And that's the best way that we don't really have a website or an email or anything like that. So.
My Facebook page, Ross Danny Fallon, you can contact me there.
And you have a GoFundMe page?
We do. which is on our Facebook page.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, all three of you, Benji, Danny, Abby, for joining us today. And really, the best of luck with the program and really best of luck with getting rid of your program if yeah. things change in the future.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks. Fight to power.
We come back now to the story of thousands of residents still displaced from the community of Porter Ranch in LA's San Fernando Valley as methane continues to spew from a massive natural gas leak. We'll talk with one of those people displaced at Porter Ranch, California's Secretary of State Alex Padilla. Sasha Coca has the story from the California Report.
I personally would feel much better if the facility was shut down permanently because I don't have faith in future regulation.
I'm very concerned about our nest egg, you know, our property value. We're at the age of, you know, close to retirement. What's going to happen to us?
Everybody's suing, but for what interest? Is it the interest of the community? Who benefits from that? Do we?
Voices from the community of Porter Ranch in LA's San Fernando Valley. Thousands of residents are still displaced as methane continues to spew from a massive natural gas leak there. This week, LA County filed criminal charges against the Southern California Gas Company. Attorney General Kamala Harris added yet another lawsuit alleging health and safety violations. She says the leak harms all of California by spiking greenhouse gas emissions. One of those displaced from Porter Ranch is California's Secretary of State, Alex Padilla. He joins us now. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Sasha, very much, and thank you for your concern on this issue.
You know, as Secretary of State, we usually talk to you about voting and elections, not gas leaks, but this has become very personal to you. What has it meant for your family?
Well, our family, just like thousands of others that live in the community of Porter Ranch, has been displaced. We're out of what we call home. My wife and I and our three little boys have been in a hotel in Burbank, a nearby community, for the last month and a half or so. So, you know, it's a public policy issue. It's a public safety issue. But for me, it's also become a personal issue.
Has your family felt any side effects? Have they gotten sick at all?
You know, when the news story first broke, you know, we immediately go on high alert because the youngest of our boys wasn't even a year old yet. He just turned one a couple of weeks ago. And so you immediately think, you know, am I putting my kids in any danger? But yeah, between what my wife and my boys were feeling, it was enough consistency that we made what was honestly a tough decision to move out of our home. We had just moved into the area about a year and a half ago. And so residents who have been there for a year, residents who have been there for 30 years, you know, your home is your home. It's your piece of the American dream. And nobody anticipates being interrupted like that.
So what kinds of symptoms were you seeing?
You know, it's the shortness of breath. Occasional, you know, headache or things of that nature, you know, with my wife and our three boys feeling a lot better since we moved out. I know it was the right decision.
How do you explain this kind of thing to your kids, especially young children? I mean, do they understand why they're living in a hotel?
No, it's you know, honestly difficult to understand. Our 8-year-old thinks it's fun because the hotel happens to have a pool. Not that we've had good weather to enjoy it. Our newborn obviously doesn't really know the difference of what's going on. And our middle boy certainly misses home. He's asking to go home on a very constant basis.
You know, Southern California Gas Company is saying they expect to plug this leak soon, and the residents who've relocated out of the area on the company's dime are going to have about 48 hours to return home, you know, once regulators certify that the leak has stopped. What do you think about that deadline?
Yeah, so my understanding is that was a time frame, those 48 hours to move back in, that was agreed to both by the gas company and the city before they had any idea the magnitude of this gas leak and the number of people impacted was going to grow to this scale. So my understanding is that's being renegotiated. But I'll tell you, as a father and as a husband, I appreciate when I hear from the gas company that the gas leak has been fixed, but I'm going to want a third-party validator here, whether it's the Air Quality Management District or a state agency, to confirm that that's indeed the case.
And has this disrupted your kids' schooling? You said you had an 8-year-old.
Fortunately, a chunk of the time that we've been displaced happened during the holiday break. So he was able to finish out last semester. We took a few weeks off for the holidays, but he has been back in school since January, and things seem to be okay. you know, the holiday period, a time for celebration, a time for family, for us was in a hotel. We spent Christmas Eve at my brother's house, but Christmas Day in a hotel, trying to keep life in perspective. Remember huddling the kids and reminding ourselves that, look, we're together. We have our health and we have a roof over our head. And there's a lot of people in the world, a lot of people here in California that can't say that. So at the end of the day, we're blessed. We're okay. Our youngest just celebrated a one year old. And it seems like his first steps are going to be in a hotel room, not in our living room. But maybe that's just a story he'll have to tell the rest of his life.
All right. Alex Padilla is California's Secretary of State and a resident of Porter Ranch.
Auto manufacturer Volkswagen has ordered recalls on over 500,000 of its vehicles, as well as nearly 200,000 vehicles from its luxury brand Audi. The recalls are over faulty airbags made by Japanese manufacturer Takata, which can rupture, spraying drivers with shrapnel. This recall comes just a day after automaker Daimler recalled over 700,000 of its Mercedes-Benz vehicles over the same issue. There have already been 10 deaths so far in the U.S. related to these airbags.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 10th, 2016. This radio broadcast will be followed by Right to Survive Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, it'll be Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be early showers with a high around 56, moving to steady rain and 50 degrees tomorrow night. Today in history, in 1763, Britain, France, and Spain signed the Treaty of Paris, ending the Seven Years' War and significantly reducing the size of France's colonial empire. Our quote of the day is from Mark Twain, who said, "Patriotism is supporting your country all the time and your government when it deserves it."
It's 5:31, time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Headlines periodically blare that this regulator or that has imposed another jaw-dropping assessment on some gross polluter or other corporate criminal. Justice Department slaps BP with $20.8 billion punishment, the media shouted months after the oil behemoth spewed billions of gallons of crude into the Gulf of Mexico. That'll teach them. Hardly. Corporate lawbreakers have colluded with Washington lawmakers to cut a sweetheart deal. Corporations are allowed to deduct huge chunks of their, quote, punishment from their corporate taxes, effectively forcing us common taxpayers to subsidize their criminality. The U.S. Public Interest Research Group recently analyzed the government's 10 biggest settlements with corporate violators, finding that 60% of the total was quietly classified as tax deductible. For example, rather than BP taking the full $20.8 billion hit that had been so widely publicized, it was allowed, without fanfare, to treat more than $15 billion of it as a tax-deductible, quote, cost of doing business. That was on top of $37 billion in Gulf cleanup costs BP had already deducted from the taxes it owed to our public treasury. Similarly, in 2013, J.P. Morgan Chase signed a $13 billion settlement for defrauding investors, but $11 billion of that was eligible for a tax write-off, just part of a corporation's routine expenses. This is Jim Hightower saying, as Perg rightly points out, when these settlements are allowed to be tax deductible, our leaders are sending a message to huge corporations like BP and J.P. Morgan that polluting our environment and ripping off the American people are acceptable ways of doing business, and that it's okay to make ordinary taxpayers subsidize these corporations' nefarious behaviors. To learn more, go to www.uspirg.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The state of Delaware has officially apologized for slavery. Delaware Governor Jack Markell signed a resolution today formally apologizing for slavery and subsequent oppressive Jim Crow era laws. The resolution makes Delaware the 8th state to issue such an apology. Virginia was the first state to pass a resolution like this back in 2007. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a similar resolution in 2008, with the U.S. Senate passing their own resolution a year later. Today's resolution in Delaware is a symbolic gesture aimed at reconciliation after years of systemic oppression and injustice. Along with the resolution, Governor Markell also issued a proclamation recognizing February as African American History Month. During today's signing, Governor Markell spoke, saying, quote, "It is not enough for us to refrain from the bad. It's not enough for us to be silent. We have to speak up, and that is what this is all about."
A well-known Black Lives Matter activist has died at the age of 23. Marshawn McCarroll II died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound on Monday in the entrance to the Ohio State House. McCarroll was the founder of the youth mentorship program Pursuing Our Dreams, as well as the action group Feed the Streets. Feed the Streets was inspired by McCarroll's own experience with homelessness, which he described as a humbling point in his life. In 2014, McCarroll helped to organize a youth protest against police brutality in reaction to the death of Michael Brown. Prominent activists and celebrities on social media have been paying tribute and expressing condolences for McCarroll. A few days before his death, McCarroll received the Hometown Champion Award from the NAACP for his activist work. McCarroll's group, Feed the Streets, will be honoring him Saturday, February 20th, by distributing free meals to those in need in Columbus, Ohio.
The United States Supreme Court decided to put a halt on Environmental Protection Agency's rules for carbon emissions of coal plants on Tuesday. 29 state governments are on the list of petitioners who requested the rule be postponed and no further action be taken on the matter until the end of summer. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Joanne Spalding from the Sierra Club to get her legal take on what's transpired and what is likely to become of climate change policy in the coming months.
What the Supreme Court ordered yesterday is a temporary suspension of the rules. It's called a stay, and the Supreme Court has not yet ruled on the merits, and the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit has also not ruled on the merits. So the process is that the parties will file their briefs and the D.C. Circuit will hear oral argument on the merits on June 2nd and 3rd. And then the D.C. Circuit will decide the case. And ultimately, the party losing at that point can petition the Supreme Court to hear the case. And then the Supreme Court will consider the merits. So this is just a preliminary procedural ruling that puts the rule on hold while the D.C. Circuit and Supreme Court consider the merits.
And that's supposed to take place in June?
The D.C. Circuit argument will take place in June, and the Supreme Court argument will probably not take place for, you know, at earliest it would be the spring of 2017, and it could be later than that.
Can you share with our listeners the timeline of when legal action was taken and go over the path to the case going before the Supreme Court?
I believe the rule was published in the Federal Register on October 23rd of 2015. The petitioners had actually filed premature lawsuits that were dismissed. They were trying to challenge the rule when it was just a proposal. It wasn't even a final rule. Then they challenged it before it went to the Federal Register. There were several lawsuits that were dismissed as premature. For the one that they filed after the rule was finalized, they then filed a motion with the D.C. Circuit asking the D.C. Circuit to stay the rule. And the three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit unanimously denied their motion for a stay.
Have you a breakdown of sorts on how many of these petitioners are state governments versus how many are commercial enterprises?
I believe there are 27 states. And then there are a number of trade organizations. There are utilities. And there are also coal mining interests. So there is a wide range. There's also a wide range of respondents who have intervened on EPA's side to defend the Clean Power Plan, including 18 states, a number of cities. There are clean energy companies, wind and solar companies. There are various utilities and power companies who have been reducing their carbon emissions. They're forward-looking companies that realize that the Clean Power Plan is achievable and, in fact, necessary, and they have intervened to defend the rule.
Across the nation, state budgets are said to be under serious monetary pressure. Can you talk about the legal costs being incurred by those governmental entities and why they're not letting industry fund their own judicial battle?
I would argue that in many situations, it would be far more appropriate for the regulated entities themselves, which are the power companies, to be the ones taking the lead on this. The investment that they've made challenging the rule would, of course, we believe, be much better spent in complying with the rule. And especially for states like, for instance, Colorado, where the governor has said that they plan to move forward despite the stay. They plan to comply with the rule, but the state attorney general is challenging it. So it does seem like a waste of the state's resources to be challenging this rule that is so essential to reduce the carbon pollution from these dirty fossil fuel-fired power plants.
The United States is expected to sign on to some global agreements as a result of the climate conference in Paris late last year. Is there any legal action that's going to have an impact on whether or not we can participate in that process?
The commitments that the United States made in Paris are the commitments through 2025. And we also have commitments to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 2020, a certain amount, 17% by 2020. If we continue on the trajectory that we're already on and have been on over the past 2 years, reducing our carbon pollution from the electric sector, we would actually overcomply with the Clean Power Plan because there's already a transition occurring from dirty coal-fired power and other fossil fuel-fired power to clean renewable energy.
I've been talking with Joanne Spalding, Senior Managing Attorney with the Sierra Club. For more information, you can visit their website at sierraclub.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Results of last night's New Hampshire primary are in. Both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders recorded clear victories, each beating out their nearest rival by 20 points or more. Sanders was projected to win, but only by about half as large a margin. And while Clinton may have an advantage in upcoming states, it is clear that the momentum of the Democratic race has shifted. On the Republican side, John Kasich placed second with 15% of the vote. Ted Cruz finished a surprising third, despite being a more conservative candidate than New Hampshire usually supports, which may be due to his breakout victory in Iowa. Chris Christie, who had pinned his hopes on New Hampshire, came in sixth and has announced he is dropping out. Carly Fiorina, who placed just behind Christie at seventh, has suspended her campaign as well, reducing the Republican field to six contenders out of the original 16 major candidates.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem. Well, we don't have the audio for that. So rather, we...
Syrian state television beamed the sights and sounds of empty villages north of Aleppo.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, February 10th, 2016. Israeli troops kill a Palestinian child and injure seven others during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers killed on Wednesday a Palestinian child in Al-Arub refugee camp north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron after several military vehicles invaded it. Doctors at Al-Mizan Hospital in Hebron said that the child was shot in the chest and that the bullet penetrated his heart and exited from the left side. Surgeons and specialists attempted to save his life, but he died of his serious wounds, doctors added. The slain child has been identified as Omar Jawabre, 15. Eyewitnesses said that soldiers clashed with dozens of local youth after the army invaded the refugee camp and fired many rounds of live ammunition, rubber-coated steel bullets and gas bombs, including at a number of homes. They added that a soldier pointed his gun at the child and shot him in the chest. Many Palestinians suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation and received the needed medical treatment. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded on Tuesday night the town of Taqwa, southwest of the West Bank city of Bethlehem, shot 7 Palestinians, including 2 brothers, while at least 20 others suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation during clashes that took place between the invading soldiers and local youth. The soldiers shot Jihad Daoud Al-Amur, 26, and his brother Ala, 24, with live rounds in their thighs, as they were standing on the rooftop of their home in the center of the town, medical sources said. Their wounds were described as moderate. The sources added that 5 Palestinians were shot with rubber-coated steel bullets and at least 20 others suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation. Some of the wounded Palestinians were transferred to the Beit Jala Governmental Hospital and the rest received treatment by field medics. On Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers have kidnapped at least 23 Palestinians, including several children, in different parts of the occupied West Bank, mainly in Jerusalem and Bethlehem. The Jerusalem Office of the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, said that soldiers searched several homes in different parts of the occupied city and kidnapped 14 Palestinians. In addition, the soldiers invaded the Hesher refugee camp and Nahalin town in Bethlehem and kidnapped 6 civilians. In Jenin, Hebron, and Tulkarem cities, Israeli troops kidnapped 3 civilians after searching their homes, local sources reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, February 10th, 2016 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Ishmael and me, Ghassan Bandura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenna Yokoyama, Galen Sanford, Jimmy Tardy, Robin Ryan, and Kristen Yount. The producer is Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Jimmy Tardy. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this news.